Coffee Sketch Podcast is our take on the intersection of old tech and new tech, the space between the traditional practice of the hand-drawn sketch that has been performed by architects and designers for centuries, and the modern-day use of the hashtag as a representation of a sentiment or a movement. Each week we plan to deliver a new pod about our ideas, sketches, and what's going on in our daily lives as we pursue our love of architecture, design, and sharing this knowledge with the next generation. I'm Kurt, and I'm in Flint.
And I'm Jamie, and I'm in Austin.
Hey, Jamie. How's it going?
Hey, Kurt. Good. You?
Oh, I'm doing very well. We have some news.
Yes, it's a big news day in the architecture world.
That's right. And, I think it's deserving to precede our coffee suggestions of the week. The Pritzker Prize was announced, and so
yes,
for us architects and fans of architecture, it's always kind of a big one. It's a big international prize, which is an exciting award because there's not very many that have a global, I think, reach of for our profession. You know,
hashtag architecture junkie, hashtag architecture love. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So we're a little behind only because of travel and things and other things we'll get to. but the Pritzker Prize winner is Grafton Architects. You were going to say.
Oh, I was going to say, but before we even, you see, you gave away the big reveal. Like, that's the whole thing. Like, for all those people who are like, what is this Pritzker Prize that these people are talking about? No,
right.
But seriously, in all seriousness, the Pritzker Prize is effectively, in layman's terms, the Nobel Prize for architecture.
Sure.
Like, it's at that level. So I will just leave it there. And then you've already given the big headline, which is, you can say it again.
Yes. Grafton Architects out of Ireland, which is pretty cool. Probably by the time this episode comes out, it will be near St. Patrick's Day. Not if that's a merging or a melding of themes here. But
yeah, for the Irish amongst us. So yes. Do you have any Irish heritage in you?
I have a little.
But on St. Patrick's Day, everyone's got a little bit Irish, you know, or at least, you know, that's the
beauty. That's right. And honestly, if I had a little bit of the style of Grafton Architects, these Irish architects, I would be totally content because the work is amazing. And your sketch, so you drew a sketch for this occasion.
Yes. And I will say that I, in all fairness, I am like so Irish, it's not even funny. But yeah.
I thought you were Canadian.
Well, I am Canadian, but
this whole time,
gosh,
we were talking about your Canadian heritage.
It doesn't, but Kurt.
Oh, you know,
immigration. Like it's a land of immigrants and migrants. Just
as
like
well.
The U.S., you know?
As well, yes. The melting pot as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and
so
and
are it, you, what's the percentage here then?
Oh gosh. Like I should do the, I never have done the math. I go to grandparents are easy, right? So you have four grandparents. Three of my four grandparents are all Irish descent. Like,
oh,
that's
wow.
It's, I mean,
well, Crawley is kind of a European.
Well, and of course Anglo, that's the, and of course that's right? The one grandparent who is, you know,
not,
well, he's part Irish, but also part Italian. So, his father, I say that in all fairness, as a lot of my family lived in like England and the boroughs around London for several generations. So, you know, the Irish linkage is a little bit more definitive on one side of my family than the other. But my grandfather, his father, was a greengrocer, and, his mother, was the greengrocer's daughter. So the man that he worked for, he immigrated to Canada with her, and his in-laws, and his first two kids. So my great uncles, or great aunt and great uncle. And then, my grandfather was born in Canada. So sort of in one generation, we, you know, kind of on that side, have quite a, link to England and London. And, and when I was in London two summers ago, was able to go and see, the shop that, my great, great grandfather, owned or started, and where my great, great grandmother lived upstairs.
No way. That's pretty cool.
So it was pretty cool. And then I got to go to the church that they got married in. And they're Italian. So they had immigrated from Italy to London and, lived in kind of the, sort of, Italian community in London. And, so Irish and Italian and then a whole lot more Irish on, amongst the rest of the family. So yeah, St. Patrick's Day.
So on St. Patrick's Day, you're more than just a little Irish. Then.
I'm more than just a little Irish. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And
reminded of it at times. I mean, my father's middle name is Patrick. So
yep. There it counts.
Yeah.
Count it. I'm an eighth. I think I'm an eighth. I'm 1/8 on my dad's mother is Irish. That makes me an eighth, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, you did the math that quickly. And have you been doing like math tutorials? Because we've talked about your math skills and
been working on it.
like suddenly you've just really impressed me. And I'm sitting there going through my whole family lineage, and all the while I know what it was. While I'm going through the lineage, you're doing the math. I didn't hear the
I'm
pencil.
Doing longhand. You I'm hit doing mute, longhand didn't you? Over here.
You hit mute. Yeah.
Off the mic.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. You've outed me once again.
Yeah.
Oh, this is so funny. So two things real quick before we talk about the sketch, is the first thing I think most important is that, and the landmark of this Pritzker, which is that Grafton Architects is run by two principals that are both female, so woman-owned business.
Absolutely, yes.
I wrote down their names because I didn't want to leave those out. Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara, and so the two principals of Grafton, and they do such great work. And then, so the second thing.
And they founded the firm in the late 70s. So this is not like a newer practice, but I mean, again, you know, this is effectively the Nobel Prize for architecture. So it's completely expected that they would have a long lasting practice, but
yeah, a little bit of a legacy, what do you call it? Lifetime achievement ish.
That's a good way to.
Not in the end of career thing though either.
No, so. It's because that's the thing is, I mean, we should talk a little bit before we. I mean, I hate doing this, but it's like, we need to get to the sketch. But I think that the Pritzker's only been around since 1979 was its first. Its first inaugural winner, and that was Philip Johnson. And then, but he continued to practice, obviously. And even though at that point he was already, quite old. But he's one of those individuals that is just going to, you know, at that point, you know, you're just like, how old is Philip Johnson now? Oh, he's 150, you know, who knows? But, and you know, I met him, right? At one point.
No, wait.
Yeah.
Unless we've recorded this, then I think I might not have.
We might have talked about it, but yeah. So anyhow, yeah, Philip Johnson, met him. You can go back to one of those Aggie episodes. I think we talk about it, but,
yes.
But so, so the prize has only been around since 79, but I mean, you know, the thing I think about the Pritzker that was, you know, just like many, many other, kind of gold medal or, you know, highest honor by an architectural society, you know, talking about career spanning awards, you know, I think it's very, very evident that, it was a male dominated selection, for many, many years. So I think their selection is one that's, both overdue, it appears, by looking at their work, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But, I think a lot of people in kind of leading up to the Pritzker announcement were, hoping or expecting it to be a woman architect. In 2004, the first woman received it, and that was Zaha, who, as any listener who's ever listened to this podcast knows, is one of our favorites. But anyhow, so I just had to get that in there because I think it's, you started to allude to it, but I think it's important for everybody to kind of.
No, yeah. Thanks for the extra reminder, because I was already kind of getting a little excited because jumping into where they're located. So I went to their website and then I went to the map because I was in Dublin a few years ago.
Oh man, I haven't been. That's just, it's on.
You haven't been to Dublin yet?
I haven't been to Ireland.
Or Ireland.
I've been to Scotland, and I've been to, you know, to parts of England, but not Ireland. So,
well, we were only briefly in Dublin area, and then we flew over to Edinburgh and went around Scotland too. But so shorter time in Dublin, but we took this walking tour around Dublin by this great local. He was so fun, and I'm pretty sure he stopped us at this bar that's right around the corner from Grafton's office.
Fantastic.
Because I'm looking at the map, because I know we wound up at Molly Malone's statue, which is like a big popular kind of local landmark. There's this song. He taught us this song to sing at the statue and all the, you know, this sort of thing. Local lore and all that, which was kind of fun. But it's like right around they're literally right around the corner from the statue, like a block away. And so they're right down in the what they call the Temple Bar area of Dublin. It's like I wouldn't say it's like it's touristy, but it's like in their one of their busy downtown areas near a lot of some of their sites to see. And so it's right there on a big main road in a cool, you know, European style block where there's, you know, party walls and all that stuff. But anyway, I was right around the corner, and I don't know if I, you know, normally when I travel and we're walking around downtowns, I kind of look at the businesses to see if there's any architecture firm. And I do find quite a few. I'll look at signs and read names and things like that and go, oh, an architect works here. And you know, usually their sign is a little
away all those things that, like, for anybody who's never ever traveled with an architect before, like on like a personal trip, you know, we're not talking work trips here. We're talking like personal excursions, you know, the urban exploration, you know, the fun stuff, you know, when you're out to dinner and you're, oh, where should we eat? Oh, I don't know. Let's walk down this street, you know, and, you know, what are the other things the architect is looking at other than the buildings? So Kurt is giving a behind the scenes look at what's going on in our minds collectively.
Yeah, a little taste. I did that in Montreal too when we went to your fair city.
Yes.
Right there's an office right by the cathedral. Just so you know. If you didn't know, now you know.
You're talking about
but
Notre
anyway.
Dame.
No, there's an architect that works in that plaza out in front.
Oh, okay.
No,
okay.
Yeah, Notre Dame, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, cuz there's lots of churches.
Sorry. Notre Dame. Yeah. The cathedral. Yeah.
And I gave you like a list of like 7 to go to and I
know. That yeah, weird. One of the most church intensive architecture sightseeing. So I digress, but sorry, I had these 2 anecdotes and now I'm done. So we can talk about your sketch, but also, you know, what it is of and the Grafton work and how, you know, relevant and I mean amazing this architecture is, as well as your sketch is amazing. Can't always, you know, forget to shout out to Jamie's technical ability as well. But so you designed.
Well, and I would say, in all honesty, it's like this is one where, like, this is the Pritzker Prize. You're gonna. I knew we would probably do an episode about this. I get excited about it every year. If it's an architect that I've already championed and sort of am rooting for or been influenced by, or you know, love to hate, or you know, in a case like this, is one that. And I think you've sort of had the similar reaction, but it's one that not necessarily I forgot about, but it's like I didn't realize it was them. And I maybe have a different take on that. But yeah, so I really, really liked this building by them. And I was excited to sketch it and wanted to do it justice. So
the building itself is, well, is the university in Milan, Italy. Luigi Bocconi. Bocconi? Bocconi?
Bocconi.
Bocconi. In Milan. So it's a university, economics school, a university building. But they have, it's this, so that's what you chose to sketch. And I don't know, were you, you've been to Italy, were you there in this?
No, this would have been built far after my last trip to Italy.
Oh, okay.
And I actually was only in Milan once, and only briefly. So never spent a night in Milan. But certainly okay. A city that, is one that I would love to get back to. And, you know, there's plenty of cities like that on my list that, and now I have like, you know, another building to add to that list. But yeah, this, you know, in looking at their portfolio, and one thing stood out to me, but which I'll mention in a minute, but this particular project really stood out. And you know, my love of Italian architecture and, is, you know, this is the one that I was drawn to and wanted to sketch. So
the building is this kind of, you know, of the brutalist styling, but in a modern way, you know, it's a lot more contemporary, geometric, but more finessed than just raw concrete. This material, I think it still may be concrete, but just done so clean and smooth. The finish is amazing.
Yeah, I think the formal geometry of it sort of stands out, and I agree with you, is that it's it does have a brutalist ethos to it, but I would say that the detailing is far more contemporary, and yeah, the, you know, this is one of those situations where definitely you have to go up and touch the building, and you know, the photos, you know, maybe only do it partial justice, but you can start to see how smooth that concrete is, and that one kind of overhanging or protruding element that is sort of present in the sketch on the corner, and then the glass element below it, you get this sort of
almost razor edge look to the concrete. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, just so beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, how, you know, pulling that off is those kinds of thin details are like what I would imagine, is something that even Mies van der Rohe would be jealous of.
Yeah. Oh no, for sure.
Execution. And not to point out, you know, someone else, but there's a certain, I guess it kind of has like what international style has become from those early mid-century or, you know, times to now, and how you can even push the aesthetic further and farther. Yeah, it's great. The shadows are just amazing. And it's, I don't know. It's getting me all excited. You know, your sketch captures exactly, you know, I was, you know, looking at your sketch, and then I flipped through their website and I was like, oh, I found the building, you know, immediately, because your sketch was so accurate. And it, you know, you're calling out that area where it has this really nice, like, glass curtain wall underneath this sloping, solid mass, where I would assume it might be like a theater or a lecture hall. Sometimes those,
yeah, you
know, sloping spaces kind of wind up being like the seating, the auditorium seating backside, something like that.
It's the backside of the section. Yeah. And then sort of there's another photo on their website where you sort of see that glass from street level, actually connects to a double or even triple height space, that is,
oh, yeah,
sort
of, there
a,
we go.
Kind of a lobby space that really gives you sort of the depth of this building, really kind of carved. And I think that's, to me, that's the biggest difference, between the brutalism of Grafton's work here, and the brutalism of, say, you know, the 1970s or 1980s, where the buildings then were also detailed in overarching structural proportions, you know, often in concrete, but they weren't carved. They weren't sculptural. And I think here you see a carving and a consciousness of that section, and those interlocking spaces that really suggest the carving of space and how people inhabit it, in things that were experimented with in the brutalism period. But I think here is executed in a completely different way. And I think that that's what's really endearing, you know, at least in my review of their work, at least, you know, here on electronically, I like to go see buildings, and view it that way. But, in this case, you know, it's a prize winner. So you gotta do what you can.
Mm-hmm. And exactly, you know, no shame in that game.
Yeah.
But they're all over the world, you know, with projects.
Oh, it's, yeah, amazing. No, well, and that's the thing, is that the, you know, being all over the world, there's projects that, and you probably have some that, you know, you've seen or thought of, and the thing that, you know, I was sort of upset with myself was I didn't realize that they were, I didn't, like, the name just didn't, it didn't connect, but they were the curators of the Biennale in 2018. Mm-hmm.
I just saw that, yeah.
And that was and what stood out to me was, that in, you know, of course it was another, you know, art exhibition, if people aren't familiar with the Biennale in Venice. So Venice does two Biennales, you know, in opposing years. So there's and then it cycles. So 1 year is an art Biennale and it's all artists, curated, mm-hmm, in multiple pavilions,
in Venice, and then there's also an architecture biennale, effectively in the same location, also curated, but there's usually a designated curator for that, and then they bring in works and installations. And then there's permanent pavilions, and many famous architects have contributed to the pavilions. But and I've been to the site for the Biennale. At the year I went, it was an art Biennale. But the thing that sort of struck me about when they were named as kind of co-conspirators of, you know, and curators of the Biennale, wasn't sort of conscious of their practice, you know, as much as I really, really liked their approach. And they had written a manifesto, and they called it Free Space. And I'm just going to, I pulled it up, knowing we were going to do this episode, but that's, you know, that sort of architectural impulse to write and then to use that as a vehicle to curate their exhibit, you know, arguably the most famous architectural exhibit, you know, held, you know, every other year, for I think over 100 years, or something crazy like that. Anyhow, the fact that they had written a manifesto to kind of guide this process and guide the people that they were either inviting or were participants in it, I thought was pretty brilliant, and I loved that idea. But it's it was also sort of based on this idea of sort of generosity and sort of a consciousness of not just sustainability, but more of the earth as an overall concept, as a client. So that we're all kind of inhabitants here. So just to read, you know, a little bit from the manifesto, very briefly, Free Space describes a generosity of spirit and a sense of humanity at the core of architecture's agenda, focusing on the quality of space itself. Free Space focuses on architecture's ability to provide free and additional spatial gifts to those who use it and on its ability to address the unspoken wishes of strangers. Free Space celebrates architects' capacity to find additional and unexpected generosity in each project, even within the most private, defensive, exclusive, or commercially restricted conditions. It just, and again, it goes on. And and I think that that idea that they were thinking about, you know, what can architecture be in this moment, you know, as they sort of exhibit works from other individuals, and those kind of collective thoughts, you know, gathered in a manifesto in this case, and calling it a manifesto, I think, you know, has a rich architectural tradition, and an artistic tradition that I just, you know, resonates with me. And I felt like, was a big part of their work. And clearly when you look at their portfolio, you can see it as well.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't even that long ago. I'm going to go back, though, and kind of review what, you know, what came out of the Biennale. Because those three statements about what the manifesto, you know, the intent about generosity of spirit and space, regardless of caste or class, you know, I mean, those are still critical discussions of architecture that we still are talking about today for the past 100 years, you know, forever. I hope that we are trying to address this universal need that space is, you know, space defined architecture, you know, is something that everybody is entitled to or deserving of, not just, you know, the 1%. Some people, I think a lot of clients kind of go, oh, you know, well, I wouldn't say clients, I guess there's a lot of people that go, oh yeah, I can't afford an architect. You know, they think it's like, oh, that's not for me. You know, and they wind up with, you know, something, but it's not always the solution that they really needed. And so we have this sort of role that I think, you know, we need to play. You know, maybe it's kind of edging on the citizen architect thing, you know, concept that we are using, but being able to connect what we've learned in our practice and what people need on a day-to-day basis and make sure that there's no lapse in quality space for everyone. And so I kind of want to go back and see what the result of the Biennale was based on how they sound like they're framing it, you know, trying to push people to think past any of those stigmas or social norms, I hope.
Well, I mean, you know, just, you know, as if you kind of look at the collection of participants that they sort of assembled, and, you know, kind of as you were talking, I was kind of looking back through some notes on it. So the Biennale itself has only happened 16 times architecturally, but that's, if it's every other year, that's over 32 years. So there'll be another one this year. You know, we're at about like 30, it's about 35 years of this kind of work, which is pretty amazing. But the Art Biennale has gone on, you know, far longer than that. And that doesn't even seem long enough to me, because I know that people like Carlo Scarpa did work for pavilions in that space. But anyhow, you know, I digress and sidetrack myself. But it you know, as you're sort of looking at, you know, who was working within this framework, you know, one that sort of stood out to me is a favorite of yours is Big was one of the participants. And of course, this is when they showcased a project which has been published widely at the time and then since then. But it was their project in Manhattan, kind of lower Manhattan, where they were talking about sort of
the housing, the housing building?
No, not the housing building. When they were doing sort
of
their,
the water.
Yes.
The waterfront. Yeah.
Yeah, sort of their necklace, right, around Manhattan was envisioned for this Biennale. So that's what Big presented. They called it at the time, and this is the only time I've ever seen it written this way, was Human Hatton. I think it's been captured in other proposals by them for, you know, different things, and it might have been, you know, morphed into it, or you know, which is oftentimes the case. You know, anything in a sketchbook, you know, any good ideas, you hold on to them. So, but I think that it's interesting because, you know, in this particular case, I'm familiar with the project, had never heard it by that name. And, you know, they even, you know, kind of in reference to the manifesto, they note a quote from a Greek proverb saying, "A society grows great when old men plant trees whose shade they know they shall never sit in."
Yeah.
You know, and that's just, you know, that's the kind of, I think, the longer range thinking that their manifesto sort of sets out for us, that we're all sort of stewards and sort of we're only here for a little while doing what we do. We want to leave things in a better place. And that was, you know, to see it in a project that I was already familiar with, but didn't realize was part of the exhibition is kind of fantastic. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's all a good reminder, you know, like I said, I'm going to go back and kind of revisit this again, but, you know, beyond just the Biennale too, though, it's the rest of their work is just so nice and clean. And, you know, something they even, you know, kind of mix materials. So it's not like just a concrete thing. There's stone and brick and wood involved in their buildings. But this really minimal aesthetic that probably, you know, nowadays, probably a lot of people would find exciting, you know, the whole group of minimalist thinkers and things like that, you know, as far as paring things down. But all as we all learn from even, again, citing Mies van der Rohe, the devil is in the details, right?
Right.
To make something look simple is not simple. And so it's a huge feat to like have any one of, I would love to have the ability to have designed one of these.
Right.
Well, they have such a body of work.
You know, and to kind of circle back to the fact that you were in Dublin, I mean, a project that you might have gone to visit or walked past is their North King Street housing project. And it's another one where I had seen this project published and, you know, it's 20 years old now. And I think that the tidiness of the scheme and in terms of plan and then the detailing of materials is really, really evident. And then there's a wonderful photo of its presence on the street. And here, you know, the building is rendered sort of in concrete and steel and glass, but then there's also sort of this brick front with a little bit of textural element, you know, for the individual units. But then they have some amazing sort of black and white photography of it sort of sitting in its context along this street. And even though it's a clearly modern building, seems to fit within the context of Dublin, or at least the context of the city that it's in. But again, like you were saying, it's, you know, these kind of concepts, you know, today would be like, oh yeah, that's the rendering of so-and-so who's doing a project in, you know, Austin, Texas. But this is a building that is 20 years old and they were executing it with that kind of level of detail and precision and craft really, really early, early on and really setting a tone for some really fantastic work in the portfolio that comes after that. But definitely if you have not looked at Grafton's work, I think it's, it shouldn't go unsaid that, you know, it's a portfolio yeah. work that needs to be looked at.
Yeah. I think, look while you're speaking about that King Street project is if you look at all their work, and this is one of the things that excites me most about my favorite architects is that each building is reflective of its context. So the architect itself is not trying to impose too much of a style to every building so that everyone knows it's one of theirs. You know, like easily, you know, Frank Gehry kind of definitely has an aesthetic that if you know some of his stuff, then you go, oh yeah, that's, it's a Frank Gehry building, or Erica and Moss, or even Morphosis at this point, they're kind of, you know, they have a lot of the same.
Or Zaha to a large degree. I mean, mm-hmm. I think she would sure. still sort of fit in that category, even though she's still one of my favorites. But
yeah, I'm not knocking. Even though I do say my favorites aren't doing that. But like, I guess what I say is what I like about architects that find a way with material and scale to fit their building in with its context, especially if you're like Grafton all over the world with different, you know, different countries, different climates, all that stuff, you know, there's a lot more involved than just the materials, you know, the location has a huge
point, you know, as far as, like I said, the climate and culture and all those things. But, you know, being sensitive to those things is I think, really exciting and more challenging, more interesting than kind of sticking to a palette that you're comfortable with. And not, again, not knocking our other favorites. But, that, you know, that's what, you know, so you look at their website and everything has something a little bit different to offer, and which kind of really makes the whole portfolio even much more rich than a different trajectory, I guess, without trying to be
too
negative, you know, but,
So I think we tried to capture it. Hopefully we did some of their work justice and would highly encourage. We'll drop some links in there for everybody to take a peek. Sure. But this firm from Ireland with work all over the world is pretty remarkable. And so for Yvonne and Shelley's work and their awarding of the 2020 Pritzker Prize, I'm glad I was able to sketch it and we were able to talk about it.
Yeah, thanks. And I look forward to next year's sketch of the new Pritzker.
Yeah.
Make this a tradition.
Are you going to do some predictions at this point?
Oh, man.
Didn't know I was going to go there. Let's leave it at the hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to leave that hanging. Yeah.
Leave it at the hmm. we'll leave it for next time.
Yep. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. We both hope that you enjoyed this episode of Coffee Sketch Podcast. Our theme music is provided by my brother, who goes by at Cold Fashioned on Instagram and Twitter. Our podcast is hosted at coffeesketch.buzzsprout.com. Find more show notes and information from this episode. And finally, if you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes and share us with your friends. Thank you.